didn't see, or what?
He didn't see us. He didn't see us until we were right on top of him. And they get out there and they get pretty lazy and loaf around the place. They think they're perfectly safe, and suddenly the destroyer is on top of them. And he only just had time to turn. He was across us like that. He turned parallel course, and then I bumped alongside of him. And personally, I'm satisfied that we sunk that submarine. I don't think he ever got in, but when I got into England, I was told by the commander-in-chief of Western Approaches, Admiral Max Horton, that the Admiralty did not give me the credit for the submarine.
Probable, or?
They gave him what they called a B probable plus, which doesn't mean much of us to satisfy my ego, I think.
What was the feeling on board when all this was happening? I mean,
well, they were all perfectly satisfied that we'd sunk him.
No, I get what I'm trying to get at now is that there's quite a far cry from the David now. I mean, you're on a vessel that can look its way out.
Oh, yes.
And you're seeing action.
Well, I think there's always a certain amount of reaction after any action where the crew decides to decide what they would have done had they been in the driver's seat. But that's neither here nor there. I sometimes analyze and think I would have been a little better to have laid off and sunk him with gunfire. But one is so keen to destroy the enemy that you do the thing that comes into your mind first. Had I laid off and shot him, I'd had to put up star shell. And with the ship coming in head on, the star shell gun was at the back end. I had to turn the ship in order to open the A-arcs for the star shell gun, in order to illuminate them so that the gun layers could see what they're doing. So I think on thinking it over, there were several different things I could have done, but I think I did the most belligerent one that was possible. And I'm very surprised to know that the submarine ever got home, which I doubt. And naturally, nobody is going to tell me whether she got home or not nowadays, because they didn't give me the Distinguished Service Order, which is the usual payment for a submarine, and they're not going to open that can of worms so long after the war. But we were thoroughly satisfied that we got him.
So you steamed into England.
Steamed into England. Once again, my ship went into dockyard hands.
Whereabouts did you go into Portsmouth?
Went into Liverpool.
Now, did you have time off in England at this point, or?
I went to London to confer with the Admiralty and so on, and to meet our Canadian office down there. And then I came back to the ship.
Well, what was your impression of wartime London and just wartime England itself?
Well, pretty much normal. It was just after the bombings, and it was all very dark and very quiet. And I lived in a hotel for several days, and life was pretty normal. Life was pretty quiet, full of soldiers, of course. And I met several of the Canadian Army. We all had dinner together and had a lot of fun. Then I went back to my ship, and the commanding officer of the ship Ottawa had gone ill, and so I was invited to go to her as temporary captain and command her, take her on a trip to Newfoundland and back, which I did. And we had a very good passage, several alarms, but nothing materialized. We didn't lose any ships. After all, this was in 43, and we were pretty much on top of the situation then. We had large escorts. We had 11 ships in the escort force at that time.
Were you commanding the escort force again?
No, I didn't command. I didn't want to take command of that. I was, although I was the senior officer, I didn't want to take command of somebody else's group, because every group understands its own CO. And I didn't want to replace him, so I went as a kind of a, just as a private ship. And I thought it was much more sensible to allow the command to stay where it was in the escort group, so I just commanded the destroyer.
And you're allowed to do this, is this correct? No, I'm trying to figure this out now. I mean, wouldn't it just state, because you were senior, you automatically assumed?
Oh, normally, unless there's agreement. And I arranged this with the commander-in-chief of Western Approaches that I should not assume command of the group. I had my own group, and I understood them, and we did courses together, and we understood each other, and it's far better left that way than to disturb the situation. So I did this one trip, and
how long did the trip take? Approximately.
Upwards of a month. It was usually 9 to 10 days, depending on the speed of the convoy. And these were so-called fast convoys. These would be moving at something upwards of 10 knots. The slow convoys moved at about 7.5 knots. And the speed of a convoy is the speed of the slowest ship.
That's right.
And
What type of goods that were being packed? Gasoline,
everything you could think of. Railways, engines, track,
food stuff,
cheese, butter, wheat, a large number of oil tankers, everything designed for the support of the British people themselves, and also for the great offensive that took place for the Army and the Air Force.
Was there any deadheading back, or did you have enough?
Oh, there'd be a lot of deadheading back, yes. Oh, yes. A lot of lightships in ballast. Very little was being exported from England.
What did you use for ballast then? Just open up the.
Oh, just. I'm not too. Au fait with what the merchant navy, how it runs itself, but they did very well. A lot of them were very high out of the water on the way back, but deeply laden on the way going over. A lot of the ships had deck cargoes, and deck cargoes of airplanes, bombs, and so on.
They're floating. Torch, too, I guess.
Incidentally, this brings to mind a cute story about the wing commander in the Canadian Air Force, who has flown a lot of missions, a very courageous young man. And he was talking to his boss one day, and who was an Air Vice Marshal. And he said, "I don't know why we have to have the Army and the Air Force involved in this war. After all, our bombing has been pretty successful. We can just bomb the daylights out of them until they surrender." And the Air Vice Marshal said, "Well, I'm glad to hear you think that." He said, "You always had a uniform to wear, didn't you?" He said, "Yes." "You always got enough to eat?" "Yes, I did." "You always had an airplane to fly in?" "Yes." "And bombs to drop?" "Yes, I did." "Where the hell did you think those things came from?"
Didn't have nothing to do with the Navy, no.
And, well, had we lost the Battle of the Atlantic, and at one time it was in jeopardy, none of these great battles fought by the others would have been possible.
You went back, you took this you took over the Ottawa for a trip over
took
and back.
The Ottawa. As soon as I got back to Liverpool, the Assiniboine was getting near ready for to go to sea again.
What about summer 43 again?
This would be in the summer of 43. Took her to sea and we worked her up, you know.
Would you do a lot of damage in the submarine?
Yes, a fair amount. A fair amount of damage. Mostly to, the chief damage was to the tail shaft, which was bent. And it had to have a new shaft. So, but they had a spare, which fitted that ship. Unfortunately, it was in Canada. So it had to be shipped across the Atlantic and then fitted into the ship. But that didn't delay anything at all. I think there was any delay on that. It was only a matter of 2 days. We went then back to sea. I was very fortunate in having enough time off. So I attended a bunch of courses in Liverpool, which were run by a chap named Captain Roberts. Who, in my opinion, was very largely responsible for the success of the escorts in the North Atlantic. He interviewed German prisoners of war, and he picked their brains, and he found out what they do, and he started to think like a U-boat commander. And this information he passed on to us in a most colorful way. And he operated a huge, big area as a battleground, and he moved model ships, and we all had control of these model ships. And it was an invaluable experience. And if you take your whole group and you do fight your battles as presented by the school, together with everybody else, you get to understand each other, and you get to know each other's abilities and failures and so on, which is a tremendous advantage. So this gave me great confidence. Once again, I went to sea, and for the first time with my group, and C3 group, and but. Once again, we went back and forth across the Atlantic without loss. Sometimes with 98 merchant ships, sometimes with, but it was always over 90. And we carried that.
It must be a very, very satisfying feeling, though. It was
such a relief from the bad days of 42 when every convoy was attacked. Very few got through unscathed. This was due to the Wolfpack attack. Once this fellow got his E-bar message off, a sighting report, if the captain's name was Schmidt, it became known in Paris as the Schmidt convoy. And then submarines were ordered in to form up in a wolf pack way, way ahead of the convoy. And this one fellow would keep contact.
What, tailing the convoy?
And while we knew that we'd been sighted, we didn't know where the sighting reports were coming from until this HFDF equipment had been provided. And then that kind of ruined the Wolfpack attack possibilities. But in 42 it was bad.
How long did you remain on convoy, sir?
Well, the situation in the North Atlantic was so improved, and people started thinking more of the invasion and so on. I was sent back to Vancouver to take once again one of the Prince boats. This time it was the Prince Henry, which had been altered to as an invasion craft.
Well, this is what, late 43, fall of 43?
Very late in 43.
And you ordered to Vancouver?
No, she was being refitted in Vancouver at the Burrard Shipyards. And I was to take her from there to England and do training with the Army and landing craft and...
through the canal.
Through the canal and on up. Both the Prince David and the Prince Henry were converted that way. The Prince Henry was converted into an anti-aircraft ship, mounting very efficient and capable anti-aircraft weapons.
And then ship. Also, and it would carry, what, 6 landing craft, is it?
Yes, she got it. The David and the Henry carried the landing craft. They carried 12, I believe it was.
Now, how would they do this? I can't visualize.
They were hoisted in very heavy davits right up into the ship. These landing, they were landing craft assault, LCAs. And they were designed to take the Army on board, go to the landing areas, lower the boats, the men would scramble down into them from scrambling nets, and away they go off to shore. And she had very modern anti-aircraft guns and control equipment and so on. They were very capable ships the second time around.
Mm-hmm. And this is all in preparation of Normandy in 44.
Yes, but unfortunately for me, I got to Vancouver and standing by my ship, and I suddenly got a telegram from the Chief of Naval Staff to report to Ottawa forthwith. So I packed a toothbrush and a shirt and got an airplane to fly me back to Ottawa, where I arrived on a Sunday afternoon, and he sent his secretary to meet me. And told me to meet him in his office at 2 p.m. Well, having sat up in an aircraft all night, and unshaven and pretty untidy, I had to have time out to get to the hotel and just do a quick wash. And I eventually met him at 2 o'clock, where he told me that I was being appointed as Director of Warfare and Training in Ottawa. I think he rather felt that I knew so much, I better come and prove it to somebody else. So I lost my ship without ever having commanded her, and I went as Director of Warfare and Training, where we had responsibility for establishing the training that was necessary and the equipment of ships. And this had been needed a lot of attention, and we had a lot of equipment fitted in Canadian ships which was obsolete, and even though the cancellation costs manufacturing wise were pretty severe, $6-8 million on occasion, we canceled these and put in and got rolling off the lines more improved equipment. And then we worked out a plan for putting this in ships, and with minimal disruption to the operational requirements. And I personally think that the whole fleet started to look up, knowing that this newer equipment and everything was coming along, and that the older equipment was being thrown out. And it made for a more capable situation. In so doing, I gave considerable thought to training. When the ship's company gathers together, is trained in its own fields. Engineers are good. The ASDIC team would be good. The captain and his officers navigational wise would be good, but the ship as a whole wasn't cohesive, it wasn't tied together. So we tried to train them for a week or 10 days in St. Margaret's Bay, south of Halifax. And there in the winter time, the weather was impossible, and the sonar conditions are famously bad off Halifax, so ASDIC equipment doesn't work too well. So I invented the idea of sending down to Bermuda, where sonar conditions were beautiful, the weather was better, submarines were available, users practiced submarines. A lot of them were Italian, ex-Italian submarines. And so this idea was accepted by the naval staff and by the naval board. And I was appointed to go down and command it. But I made a deal before I left with the chief of naval personnel that I needed more sea time and I wanted to go back to sea. Chief of naval personnel was Captain Humphrey McMaster, if I remember correctly, who prior to the war was an ex-naval officer who had become a director of Schlesinger's.
Sporting goods.
Yeah. Yeah, he was a very capable fellow.
And you made a deal for more sea time.
Well, I felt that I had to go back to sea. I wanted to go back to sea more than I had been. You get awfully tired of shore-going jobs when the war is actually at sea. So I made a deal that he would not leave me there any longer than 6 months. Just to get the thing started, I'd invented and I'd had all the ideas of how it should be run. And so I went to Bermuda for 6 months, took my family down with me.
So we're talking, what, 44?
Early 44, yes. So we created this training base, which was called HMCS Summers Isles. And we trained, in the first 6 months, 85 Canadian ships for 3 weeks each, some longer. If they needed it, we kept them longer. And I was very confident of those ships' companies when they left us. They knew their jobs, and they knew what their enemy was, and they understood what they had to do.
How did you feel about not being made a captain at this point? Now you had you reverted back to commander.
Yeah, I converted back to once again. I was made a captain when I went as director of warfare and training.
Well, acting captain.
Acting captain. And after I'd left Summers Isles in 6 months' time, I was appointed to a ship which was then in England, HMCS Iroquois, one of the tribal class destroyers. And I went back to the rank of commander again.
Did this not bother you a little bit?
No, it was understood.
It's all part of the game, or what?
Yeah, all part of the game, and it didn't bother me. The pay was a little less, but pay was relatively unimportant in wartime. Only had enough to keep the...
Well, it's had an extra stripe, though, isn't it?
Well...
keep cutting it off the uniform?
Oh, yeah, I had the marks on my uniform and could always boast of those. But I left Bermuda and went to New York, flew to New York, and then went with 17,000 American troops on the Queen Elizabeth across the Atlantic and joined HMCS Iroquois.
As freight, so you went over as a passenger. You didn't.
No, I went as a passenger.
Didn't have to form part of ship's company at all.
No. You couldn't move with that number of men on board. They had to keep them where they were. They weren't even allowed to go up for boat drill.
How was your conditions, though? You had the rank to what, more at a cabin or?
I shared a cabin with 9 others. I think it was
9.
Yeah. Oh, she was pretty crowded. 2 meals a day. And it was really jammed in. Half the men would sleep inside one night, and then they slept outside in the deck the next night. And these were 17,000 Americans.
God. And one torpedo, and they could have made quite a difference on that.
Well, she moved at 28 knots all the way across the Atlantic, and a submarine is only a good weapon if he happens to be in the right place under those conditions.
28 knots is really highballing, isn't it?
Yeah, and she zigzagged all the way. And a very capable ship.
Well, how did it feel to be a passenger now on board, every time you've been on board ship?
Oh, I relaxed. I was relaxed. There was no drinks on board. Being an American, taken over by the Americans, there were no alcohol of any kind, so a cocktail party was a pretty dull affair. I arrived in England, and
this is prior to D-Days, that's correct?
Yes. I met the Iroquois as soon as we arrived. There she was. So I went over and joined, and I relieved Commander Jimmy Hibbard.
Admiral Hibbard.
Admiral Hibbard.
Yes.
Who is living here in Victoria. And he was going on to another job, and I took over from him. Well, almost immediately we were sent down to the channel, and D-Day had occurred by now. It occurred in June, and the tremendous movement of ships around the coast of England, mostly fast ships, about 18, 19 knots. And in spite of fog, we used to move these ships up and down the channel and around the lands.
The Iroquois is fairly fast. It's a destroyer, right?
Oh, yes.
Fairly tribal class. That was the latest one, wasn't it, at that time?
Yeah, very loaded with gun power. She was a fleet destroyer as opposed to an escort destroyer. She had twin 4.7 guns.
How did it feel to be driving again?
Oh, she was a beautiful ship. Beautiful ship. Well trained, you know, everybody had experience by this time. And I found that the Iroquois was a ship in which one could have complete confidence, regardless of employment. We went and worked in the channel for a while, escorting fast merchant ships. And I thought I was back on escort duty, and I would sooner be on a more active role. So I went to see the staff of the Commander-in-Chief in Portsmouth, in Plymouth, rather. We were stationed in Plymouth. And, Yes, that's right, Plymouth. And I asked whether I couldn't be attached to the home fleet, which was then in Scapa Flow. And so this request was answered, and all the remaining tribals, one had been sunk, the Athabascan had been sunk, but the Haida and the Huron and the Iroquois went together to join the fleet in Scapa Flow.
You need to be a Canadian squadron type of thing, or what?
Yes, yeah, it was a Canadian, I was senior officer of the Canadians.
But all under British control?
All under British control, yeah.
That wouldn't matter at all at this time, or
not a bit.
Canadianization at this time.
No,
there
not
was a
bit.
Policy.
We fitted in beautifully with the British.
Yeah, I was wondering. Now I know because of the naval tradition. Of course, you've been over to the English school, and most of your fellow, you know, your colleagues had been.
Yes.
But I know, like the Air Force, there was a major policy of Canadianization to get Canadian flyers out of the RAF and into the RCAF.
Yes.
And I was wondering if if any slop over came to the Navy at all.
No, this never raised its ugly head in the slightest. The great thing to do was to contribute, and this we did. And we were completely a unit. Every ship is a unit by itself.
Mm-hmm.
And we felt perfectly satisfied as long as we were all Canadians in the same ship. And if our orders came from the Commander-in-Chief of the Home Fleet or from Commander-in-Chief of Western Approaches or something, it didn't matter in the slightest. We did what we were told.
And did the Canadian out of these tribal class destroyers act as a squadron, or is squadron the proper term?
Flotilla would be the
proper
term for destroyers.
Destroyer
but usually there's nine destroyers in a properly organized flotilla. But we didn't work as a unit, although we were all sent on the same jobs. So we were, but we were part of a British force, and we would come under a Captain D, Captain of Destroyers, and he would be Royal Navy. But we worked in beautifully with the RN destroyers. You can never tell one from another. We did various jobs. The commander-in-chief would have meetings on board one of his flagship battleship, Rodney, I think it was, and he would design things for the fleet to do.
Well, how much was there doing for the fleet? I mean, the Germans had their handful. The high seas fleet wasn't.
Well, we, for instance, we used to take. We did this on a couple of occasions. Took six aircraft carriers, of which one was Canadian, the Puncher. We'd lost the Nabob. We had two aircraft carriers working out of Scapa Flow, but one got torpedoed. And the Puncher and five more would form the main body of the fleet, with Commander-in-Chief riding in one of them, and then surrounded by a complete escort of destroyers. And we'd go into the Norwegian coast, where we'd fly off all our aircraft, and they'd go and beat up German installations, wireless stations and lighthouses or anything that we thought was of any use to the Germans.
So you're still raiding in that sense?
They went.
You were raiding then?
Yeah, raiding. Mm-hmm. On one occasion, they, four destroyers, three British and myself, the Iroquois, went into Stavanger, which is the mm-hmm. south end, where the convoys have to come out into the North Sea to round this Stavanger before they can get back into the leads and the fjords of Norway, the coast. And there were oil tankers and supply ships going up to supply air bases at Trondheim and all the way along the coast. And we, four destroyers, went in there one night and went in at very high speed. We were sighted on the way in, and we were told not to attack if we were sighted. And we were sighted by a JU-88 who reported our position. But he reported our position as being 16 miles to the south of where we actually were. We had experts on board that could decipher these signals just like that. And
so this pilot didn't have a clue where the hell you were then?
No, he reported this being 16 miles, and he reported this as MTBs, motor torpedo boats, okay, instead of destroyers, which gave us confidence that they didn't know what the hell was going on. So we went in and we caught a convoy of 11 ships coming around the corner there. And we went into action for 4.5 minutes, and we got six of them.
We just
let them have it for all they were worth. Put up star shell. And he fired back, but typical of the Germans, they always fired high, and we had things breaking in our mast. But no hits. And so we closed in, launched torpedoes, and there were some monumental blow-ups as ammunition ships, and one oil tanker caught on fire. She made a pretty good fire out of that. And later I was in Oslo, and I met a man from Stavanger who told me that they'd beached several of them and so on. Anyway, we sure caused a lot of havoc in that convoy. And then we came.
This is what now, July, August 44, or much later?
No, this would be in 40, early in 45.
Early 45.
Yes.
What was the attitude then? Was this a question of marking time now after the invasion, or was it still touching cold?
No, I think that we at sea always felt pretty much touch and go. The U-boat had come back with homing torpedoes and this kind of thing. We never knew what to expect. We had to be on our toes, and we were still going.
Wasn't Tirpitz and Schoenhorst not still around, or they'd already been knocked out?
They were still around, yes. They were.
How much did that plague on your mind at all? I know it.
Well, there was always a worry. That's why the home fleet couldn't move. Had to stay in Scapa. But intelligence had grown enormously, and as our air power increased, we knew exactly where they were and so on. And we had complete confidence that nothing, if anything moved, the Admiralty would advise all forces, and we'd know what to do about it.
It seems almost incredible now, looking, I mean, I understand the Tirpitz is a fabulous ship, but it virtually pinned down a fleet all by itself, didn't it?
Yeah, that together with a couple of pocket battleships. And I think there was only one left. Yes, there was only one left. Scharnhorst had gone. It was the Graf Spee had gone.
Bismarck in Deutschland? Is it Deutschland?
The Deutschland, yes.
That would be the only one left. With Graf Spee and Bismarck were both small. Graf Spee scuttled in the River Plate, and Bismarck was sunk.
Yeah. Well, the Bismarck was sunk. She was a battleship, of course. But there was the Tirpitz, another battleship. And one of the pocket battleships was left. There's not the
Deutschland, was it the Neisenau?
I forgot. But on return to Scapa, I was sent for and told that all Canadians would be going on the next Murmansk convoy.
In Russia?
To Russia.
Oh, Christ.
And
that was the worst one of the bunch, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was a terrible route. Added to which, I was to go around to Rosyth and pick up 14 Russian sub-chasers. They were 110 feet long, built in Florida, and they'd been escorted by Canadians across the Atlantic, and they'd spent the winter in British ports. And now they were to be delivered to Russia in Murmansk. And I was to be the sheepdog for these 14 Russian sub-chasers. I was to go and get them. Another Canadian destroyer assisted me on this. We took them into the Shetland, Faroe Islands, and where we nursemaided them. We fixed them up, and we wined them, and they dined them, and we repaired them, and we did everything we could for them. And the entertainment was really quite stupendous. Those Russians, the way they drank whiskey was unbelievable. They'd fill a glass to the brim and then say bottoms up and push the whole thing in. And that was too much for me. I couldn't compete. And but we had dinner on board their ships and served borscht, delicious soup and so on. Altogether, we got along very well. It wasn't until we got to sea, and we went to sea at the appropriate time and joined the Murmansk convoy, which was on its way. 26 merchant ships surrounded by 27 warships. That was the sacrifice that Mr. Churchill was remaking for Mr. Stalin. More warships than merchant ships, including one cruiser, two aircraft carriers, nine fleet destroyers, nine outside escorts. She had a double skin of escorts for submarines to go through. We started from Murmansk. We went pretty close to the ice, go as far north as we possibly could to get away from the airfields of Trondheim. We had sent fast mine layers up ahead, ships that did 30 knots, and loaded with mines, and they created a minefield right across the mouth of Kola Inlet. Kola Inlet is the inlet that leads to Murmansk. And we had to be very careful of our navigation not to get and go through the gap, and never quite sure whether the mine layer had laid the mines in the right place or not. So we picked them up by sonar, and we knew we were pretty well safe. And we left we weren't sighted on the way around at all. And we arrived with all ships, and we were supposed to be met by a dozen or so submarines off the mouth of Kola Inlet. And we lost one escort, but three submarines were sunk on the approaches to Murmansk. And we got the merchant ships in safely into the inlet. Then we turned around and went to sea again and picked up the cruiser and the aircraft carrier, which had stayed behind. And we brought them through at very high speed, fast as we can go. And but we got them all in without any loss, any further loss. We lost one escort vessel. We stayed in Murmansk for 4 days, and then we picked up the outgoing convoy, equal in numbers, about 26 merchant ships. And we started out with that. And we got clear of the coast and up pretty close to the ice when we got a signal from the senior British naval officer of North Russia, who was we had met and so on. And I give them full marks for the speed with which they decoded and coded up. They'd had a message from the underground of Norway saying that aircraft was about to take off. They knew a convoy was there and so on, mm-hmm. and they were coming. So we launched aircraft from the fighters. They were all fighters.
What aircraft carrier was with you?
We had two aircraft carriers. They were Woolworth type, built by Kaiser in mm-hmm. the States here. Small aircraft carriers. Exactly what their names were.
What was your cruiser?
The cruiser was the... I'm darned if I can remember her name. She was a very modern, latest-type cruiser.
The Belfast, wasn't it?
No, it wasn't the Belfast. It was a ship of about the same size. A little later in design than the Belfast.
Okay.
The aircraft were sighted by our fighters, and we listened jubilantly on the blower as he came up with tally-ho and so on. And but the Germans were by then pretty chicken, and they turned tail and they ran back to Trondheim. We never even saw them. And which was kind of a disappointment at that day. We had such fine forces, and people were so well trained, and the equipment was so good that we were finally ready. And so it was a bit of a disappointment that we never came through. And the U-boats, we think we were sighted several times by U-boats, but with that formidable force, they didn't dare attack. So we got around the corner and headed south without
any... Is there much problem of icing the ships?
Oh yes, in bad weather the salt water spray is on board and it freezes immediately when you're in the cold water. Temperature of the water up there is about 29. And...
wouldn't be packing tons of ice, wouldn't it?
Well, we kept knocking it off as much as you could, but if you got into really bad weather with the... Well, the spray was coming on board a lot, you had to do an awful lot of chipping. You had to keep the guns clear, ready to move, and it has to be chipped. There's no way you can turn steam onto it, because that's fresh water and it freezes solid. So you have to just go at it with chipping hammers or pickaxes or whatever you can to get it off and wash it over the side. If you're short of oil fuel, you have to worry a lot about ice, because it's all top weight. And the oil fuel, if you're short, is the weight in the bottom, and your ship can get top heavy and roll over. You get too much of it on, so you have to fight it all the time. That's a very tedious job. But on the way back from Murmansk, just to tell you the problems of a sailor, one of our men, fortunately wearing a beautiful life jacket that we were provided with, called the RCN life jacket, which has a little flashing light on his shoulder, he tried to walk along the deck. The ship was pitching rather heavily, and he went over the side, over the rail and everything. Fortunately, somebody saw him go. And so I was happened to be on the bridge, and I heard this cry, "Man overboard." So the doctor arrived almost immediately. He heard the cry too, and he said to me, "You've got 10 minutes to get that man back on board. Otherwise, in that cold water, you'll be gone." So I turned around and informed my senior officer that I'd lost a man over the side, and went back at fairly high speed, as fast as I dare in the sea that was running. And I took the ship up alongside of him. There was no way I'd get a boat down. A boat would have been swamped, I'm sure. So I took the ship alongside of him.
Beg
pardon?
He could see him because of this flashing light?
Yes.
Oh,
and he, two men went down on a scramble net. And they stationed themselves, and as he came alongside, they just picked him up by the shoulders and threw him on board with superhuman strength, the strength that comes to one in emergencies. And it took us 12 hours to warm him up under about 10 heated blankets. I thought he'd been gone, but we got him back in 6.5 minutes, which was kind of a record.
Yeah. We're just above the tape, so I'm going to have to shut her down. Thank you very much.